Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
All my bets were safe. There just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome into the latest Behind the Bets podcast. We are taping this on Wednesday, February 12th. Really interesting pod, one of my favorite ones coming up. We're going to chat with Preston Johnson in a little bit. Preston, obviously you know him and his beard from Daily Wager. He's been on this podcast before. We're going to talk college and NBA, some sort of new developments in the NBA, particularly with the Houston Rockets, and then also some college teams that might have some value this next stretch. And Preston has a mid-major he really likes. We'll dive deep into that and just the, sort of the overall concept of modeling. And someone like myself and many of you do not model games, but you can sort of appreciate the math involved. And if you have any sort of visualization of math and stuff, you'll able to glean some knowledge and some wisdom from the overall concept of sort of simulating games and modeling. And then we're also going to talk to a legend, a pioneer in sports betting industry, Jimmy Vaccaro, who has just been, you know, as synonymous with betting and Las Vegas odds making as anyone. He was the only bookmaker and odds maker who posted odds on the Mike Tyson Buster Douglas fight February 11th, 1990, 30 years ago. We just had the anniversary yesterday, so I wanted to get Jimmy on, and he had some other insight in terms of the industry and just really story time with Jimmy. You can never go wrong. So those are the two guests coming up straight ahead. Plus, I want to remind you, check out the SV Pod this week. Scott Van Pelt talked with Gonzaga head coach Mark Few about his career and why seedings this year in the tournament won't be a big deal. Download and subscribe to SV Pod and Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. There's plenty going on at DraftKings, the leader in daily fantasy sports. DraftKings will have millions of dollars in total prizes up for grabs this week. Take your shot at big cash prizes with basketball contests every day, or take a swing at golf, hockey, and more every week. Draft your lineup and feel the sweat like never before. Get closer to the sports you love when you play daily fantasy sports with DraftKings. Drafting your team is simple. Just select your players and stay under the salary cap. And don't forget, there's still football going on with XFL action this weekend. Plus, when you join DraftKings today, you can play free for over $100,000 in prizes with your first deposit. Get in on all of this week's action. Download the DraftKings app now. Enter code Doug, that's D-O-U-G, during sign-up and get a free shot at over $100,000 in prizes with your first deposit. Don't forget, that's code Doug, D-O-U-G, and get a free shot at over $100,000 in prizes with your first deposit. Minimum $5 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details.
Nerd alert!
That's usually reserved for Mike Clay, but I'm doing it for Preston Johnson because I really want to nerd out a little bit with someone who uses a model and really understands the math of all this. Preston, good to connect with you again, man.
Likewise. Thanks for having me on.
All right, so I want to focus on the modeling concept for someone like myself who does not model. And a lot of our listeners kind of appreciate the math angle and sort of lens without having doing it themselves. At least I hope they do, because obviously the more information, the better. And so my understanding, when you say you model a game, it's almost like you simulate a game how many times?
Right. So you have like a projection that would be the average. You could do it 1,000 sims. You could do 10,000. You could do 100,000. It gives you the average expected score. And then you can, you know, derive a point spread from that or a projected total from that. So if I think like the example last night, Rockets Celtics just played, you know, I had it Rockets -2 and the total about 233. So I passed on the game before the game. I wasn't involved. But what was interesting about that one particularly is generally for most teams, you kind of know how many minutes everyone's going to play. Boston's a little tougher. And then now whoever the Rockets play is just going to be tougher because you don't know how they're going to go about countering what the Rockets are doing with this small ball. And so I wasn't sure, like, how many minutes is Daniel Tice going to actually play? Is Tatum going to play 20 plus minutes at center? He's 6'8". He'd actually be the tallest player on the floor still. Are they going to play a bunch of Enes Kanter and try to just beat him up down low inside? that one was really tough to model or project because there was a lot of uncertainty on how Brad Stevens would attack Houston overall. And I think that's going to be the case for a lot of Rockets games. But overall, like you're getting to in general, you kind of get an idea, okay, so-and-so's in or out, they're playing, this is their lineup, this is the projected minutes for these guys, rotations, and it's a lot easier to kind of do that sort of simulation for your projections that will give you a really trustworthy number.
Okay, so I'm visualizing like a bell curve meets a shot chart. So like a shot chart of all the outcomes in that 100,000 simulations of that game, that matchup on that particular day, just how many outcomes, like the obviously the edges of the bell curve are like 50-point wins or 40-point wins, and then as it gets closer, each team winning. So like the each axis is just like each team, but it's not zero at the fulcrum. It's more in the middle is the tie of when a point spread's like two, right?
Yeah, it would vary completely on the point spread. If you had a 10-point favorite, then that would more likely be the fulcrum or the middle point. And then the branch off extremes would be the 10-point favorite winning by 10 to 20 rather than the 10-point favorite, or excuse me, I should say the 10-point underdog winning by 10 to 20 rather than the favorite winning by 30 to 40 or something. So those, yeah, the bell curve, I think, is a really good visualization for people just to kind of understand the distributions of results and how they balance. But yeah, generally around where the market has the number is going to be where you're 50%. More or less sliced.
Okay, so as just everyone's following along, you got a bell curve, and the middle of the bell curve is all shaded, right? Like the top point is where like the point spread is. Or in Preston's case, if he has an edge, if he made it three, and it was like the spread was like pick 'em or something, so then it would be an advantage.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have that, and you mentioned the Rockets. I think that's a great point, how you're just so much unknown with the opposition, like how the Celtics are going to play them, and there's a lot of criticism out there, but we touched on the show. On the last two decades, only Shaq, now Shaq did it five times, but only Shaq had more points than Russell Westbrook in a 10-game span. So think about that. It's Shaq had like the top five in terms of total points in a 10-game stretch, and then Westbrook. And what that this has done, getting rid of Capella, bringing in Covington, has just put five shooters on the court and allowed Westbrook all the lanes to go attack the hoop. And I think it's so fascinating, and I think it's brilliant by D'Antoni and his staff.
So for to give people a little bit of an inside look on the show, so we actually covered this yesterday, Tuesday, on Daily Wager, and we actually had another guest on, I think, that you had planned to discuss with originally that ended up not being able to make it. They threw it at me about 7 minutes before the show was starting, this Westbrook graphic, and it ended up being like my favorite segment we've done in a couple of weeks, and it's not even betting related, but it really put into it kind of was a light bulb moment for me on what the Rockets have been trying to do with this approach, because I've been trying to figure it out. And I'm like, I understand it to some degree, like, oh, let's increase variance. Let's shoot 50 to 60 threes instead of 40. Like maybe we can get hot in the playoffs, but they've realized, and this is like speaks to their brilliance, that if they take their center, who is now PJ Tucker, and put him in the corner, and they take the opposing center and rim protector out of the equation from the inside, from the paint, that they could have guys like Westbrook and Harden who just go isolation. They're relentless at attacking the rim. They're either making it at the rim, they're getting fouled, which they're great free throw shooters generally, or they're just doing both. And like you're just going to score at a rate that's really tough to stop. And if the other team tries to go down and help, they can't do that because Tucker shoots over 40% from the corner. And that's like a 1.2 point per possession, which would be the best of all time. So you can't really leave Tucker. And that's what Westbrook's been doing, is just eating alive inside because he's such a great finisher and attacker, and he's relentless there. And when it's all said and done, he's also shooting way fewer three-pointers. Even when he's wide open, he's just kind of waiting around and doing what I think people would hope Ben Simmons would do more often and just attack, because that's where his advantage lies. And so they've really, I think, changed and formed Westbrook to being this elite player. That's why their offense is so good. Now, I think they're still going to get out rebounded a lot. They're going to have more deficiencies defensively, but they think overall this is going to set up for them to have a better shot long term. And so far, I mean, just I mentioned this yesterday on the show, I have to just say one more time, like they changed rules. Shaq was so dominant, the league changed rules for Shaq. And Westbrook is dominant on that level. So just think of like in 5 to 10 years, this would never happen. But what if the league was like, man, this is getting out of hand. Like, we need to make teams roster a 7-footer or make sure a 7-footer's on the floor X amount of minutes a game. Like, just so this doesn't happen, because they're breaking the league, which is what Shaq was doing. And it sounds crazy, and so it is crazy. But the Rockets are doing crazy, and it might work. And it all kind of like fell into place for me yesterday. And it's just going to be fun to watch and follow going forward.
I'm glad you articulated that light bulb moment, because it kind of clicked for me. It's like, all right, if we're going to do it, we got to do it right. And this maximizes Westbrook. I think that's what everyone's been sort of searching. I always said I wish Westbrook would be traded to the Spurs And then so Popovich would figure out the best way to use him. And that I was so fascinated.
Yeah.
Because I thought he should be a two. I've always said that, you know, not always, but like once he was like really kind of being destructive at the OKC, I was like, you know, he probably should be a two. But obviously the game has evolved in those last few years, so it really doesn't matter anymore. I just think whatever you lose on defense is what the Rockets are processing, you know, giving up a two, you gain elsewhere. And whatever it was, Wes Unseld, whoever said 80% of rebounds or 90% of rebounds are below the rim anyway. So,
right.
You know, the height thing, but they become such a liability on the defensive end. And also, and you see that a lot when you get some of these like really short point guards like Tim Frazier or some of these other guys, and then you get these guards posting them up. It just kind of throws off the other team's offense when they're trying to do something like that because it's not what they practice. So if you're just going to like pick on Tucker guarding JaVale McGee or whatever, it's like, all right, fine. Then kind of mix up your offense and do that, and we'll give up the few inches and we'll still take our threes in the other. Because what they do for that Tucker corner three, they also set a nice baseline pick, whether it be Tucker picking and then House is in the corner or the other way around. And they so they rotate the ball. So what happens is Harden's on like the left elbow three-point area, and he's thinking about driving, and if he doesn't, he swings it to his right on the opposite side, which is where Westbrook is. And then Westbrook either drives, and again, nobody's in the paint, drives, and if not, they kick it to the short corner, and then there's like a baseline pick to free up the short corner three. So obviously it's predicated on timing, but it's really beautiful offense. So and if you look at what they've done, they lost to the Suns after the big Lakers win back-to-back road games, flat spot, obviously get blown out, and then the huge comeback by the Jazz. But other than that, it's been working. So I am fascinated by it, and I wonder, Preston, I've said this on the show before, how would it be viewed today if they actually did beat the Warriors, because they were so close, Chris Paul got hurt, they missed a million threes in a row. I mean, they're right there already in this current form, and then they make this sort of change to go really small ball. So I wonder how all these naysayers would just look at it differently if a few threes fell in the playoffs or Chris Paul didn't get hurt.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, like, if that changes the whole landscape of the league to some extent, potentially, like, there's so many ramifications. Had they not missed, was it 27 threes in a row when they had a double-digit lead? Like, anything could have happened there, and maybe Chris Paul's never traded in that way, but they're doing it. So for them, just kind of the ultimate point here, it's all a math problem. They figured out, oh, we're giving up X amount of points per possession, maybe going smaller. It's not that much compared to Westbrook getting to the free throw line or getting layups almost every other possession, or wide open threes, which where we have all of our guys but Westbrook can now hit threes because Capella's off the floor. So they figured out the math problem. They think this is going to be a better result, you know, in a vacuum long term. And it might be, especially I think a year where the Lakers and Clippers, it's their first year together. They're trying to figure it out, like that whole thing. Like, it's tough to just like, oh, right, let's pull Paul George in and Kawhi and then just like win a title. Like, I still think they should be the favorites. I'm not saying it's going to be Houston, but it's not a bad year to take this risk, in my opinion.
Yeah, and they did it mid-season, which is also cooler, too. It's not like they just traded him in the offseason. So let's switch to the team that is the number one overall seed right now in the regular season. That's the Bucks, 46-7. Somehow this team is kind of under the radar. Maybe not totally under the radar, but underappreciated, and they're monsters against the spread. And tonight it looks like they're going to go without Giannis, and something you've touched on with the over-unders, and they're 5-0 right now this year, ATS, and straight up without Giannis.
They are 5-0 ATS. Now, I didn't even know that when we did it the other day. I bet on them when we did the total, and I bet the over, and I'm mainly looking at guys, you know, even just throughout the last few years where I've done player evaluation. And I think the market in general knows how much a player is worth to a point spread, but there are a lot of inefficiency in how much a player is worth to a total, right? Certain guys we've talked about over the course of this season are Karl Anthony Towns, Trae Young, Kyrie Irving. Giannis is one where people expect, and the markets especially, the first four or five games he missed, I would say the first four, when he was out or it was announced he was resting, the spread obviously dropped down, but the totals were dropping. And I just don't think it was correct. Now, they played a little bit of a faster pace when Giannis is on the floor, but they're 9 points worse defensively per 100 possessions when he's off the floor. And they're actually, so far this season, not sure if it's going to be like a long-term truth, but they're almost 2 points better per 100 now when he's off the floor. Like, they've been really good offensively. It speaks to Mike Budenholzer's system. The other Milwaukee players who are kind of just don't get enough credit, like you mentioned, just the team as a whole hasn't got enough credit. And so I think these totals should be going higher. Now, the one, this last one, it was against Sacramento. The news, it kind of sat and then ended up moving up a point after the news that he was officially going to miss the game, which was the first time it hadn't dropped. Those other four occasions, it had dropped like way too low. So that was just something that stood out to me that, you know, we've been able to attack, whether it be on Daily Wager or outside of it, when we're betting these totals. This is one I would say, because they are playing tonight, if anyone hears this before the game, I think is fair. They're playing Indiana, but I think the one is short. Even without Giannis, I laid one. I had it put more like -3 projected. And this gets to, I know you want to get into it a little bit with Toronto too, but it's also, it's a very interesting point. And I'll let you re-team me back using the Toronto example. But Indiana has been really bad since Oladipo's gotten back. And I understand why, right? You're trying to fit who was your best player, most impactful resource, back into a lineup that was playing really well. And that's like the Pacers, you think, oh, maybe it'll be an easy fit because they're the Pacers and like they're very like scheme oriented, a lot of good X's and O's stuff that they run. But like Brogdon was used to having the ball a ton, and now Oladipo needs to have it. And plus he's just been really inefficient, not 100% yet. So like how much stock do you put into recency? For me, I think it should be more like 3. The Bucks still kind of getting undervalued. They even covered against the Kings, right? Like I think the number was 10.5 Crazy, without Giannis. They even get there anyways. Like it's just what they've been doing. No reason to back off now when my number says it should be closer to a -3 spread.
Yeah, they've been relentless. And you brought up Buds. I thought maybe they'd pull back a little bit this year because of what happened last year. They were kind of regular season champs. And then Buds was as well when they were the Hawks and then got swept by the LeBron's Cavs. So it's like I thought Budenholzer maybe learned his lesson. But no. Now, granted, Giannis is only averaging, what, 33 minutes or something. So they are doing it in an efficient way. But I thought they would be doing more load management this year and things along those lines. But I like them tonight against the Pacers as well. I think they're fragile right now as Indiana. I don't think they trust themselves. And that's just sort of the eye test. Switching gears, you just mentioned the Raptors, 15-game win streak right now, franchise record. They continue to extend. And that's the question about modeling. So obviously the more data, the better. But is there a way, and you know, someone like yourself, who I really respect because you weigh in the old school handicapping component to a certain, sometimes like a gut check, but isn't there a way to sort of weight the recent stretch? Cause anyone who's played sports knows that like there is such a thing as team chemistry, and sometimes it's just health. Sometimes it's just a good vibe on the team. But when a team's hot, like a 15-game win streak, I would imagine recent play should be weighted when you're trying to model.
So this is really intriguing and interesting to me. So I was having dinner pretty recently. It was either like a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, we'll say, with someone that he's well-respected. I'm not going to say who it was, just in case. He's well-respected in the gambling community. He's a professional. And he mentioned, just like not even like getting into a discussion intentionally, they bet NBA and weighing recency in the NBA. And he's like, yeah, we do a lot of like recency stuff. And I was like, wait, so like, what do you mean? Like, were you betting the Grizzlies a lot the last month? Cause I found myself betting against them. It worked sometimes. It worked, didn't work others. Anyway, it opened my eyes to, and I'm not a good enough programmer, I think, to really historically like back test and see like when teams got hot, how did they perform after 3-game winning streak versus 4 versus 5 relative to the market expectations. And, you know, for the Raptors, like once you win 8, 9, 10 in a row, like how much better are you than if you had only won 5 in a row, right? Like it's really tough to quantify, at least for me. There's people out there that are probably doing it. This individual himself probably is doing it better, but it made me realize that my current weight that I give recency versus my season long data or my prior preseason data that I'm using, which all kind of molds into this equation, probably isn't strong enough. And I've been wanting, you know, this is really, it was 2 weeks ago and I haven't done enough work on it yet, but I need to put, I think, more weight into recency, which kind of like, you know, gave me a light of like, okay, this is where I can make an improvement and maybe have fewer times where I'm betting against Memphis. I'm trying to think of another example this year where I felt like a certain team was just super hot and I was betting against them. Like Toronto, I haven't been betting against them luckily in this instance, but to win 15 in a row, like, there's something there. And like Kyrie Irving's, I think, still out for the Brooklyn Nets. The Raptors are only -3.5 on the road. Now, Marc Gasol is out again. I think that was confirmed very recently. So that their defense suffers pretty heavily when he's out off the court. But as a whole, like, I mean, I just can't step in front of Toronto. And I feel like these guys, some of the sharpest I know, bet the biggest I know, were giving more credence to recency than I ever had. And kind of, and he just said it like kind of as like a side thing, where like maybe they're even past that. That's just like already part of their model and stuff. So I was very intrigued by it and something I needed to dig into for sure.
It makes sense. And something I've heard in the past, and it, maybe it's applicable here, I think you kind of touched on this. You know, we talk about in the old school handicapping world, like flat spots, revenge spots, letdowns. Like the math modelers I've spoken with, not a ton, but a couple, have said, like, no doubt it exists. It's just hard to model. So, like, a team being hot, to your point, what you're saying is, like, where do you draw the line? 4, 5, 6? What value do you put on a 5-game? Now, is it, do you factor in, like, the opponents? Are they bad? Are they good? You know?
And right.
So all of it is just a lot of uncertainty. So, yeah, you can believe in it, but can you totally quantify it and model it? I think that's where it's tough. And that's why I was asking it, is like, is there even a way to do it? Or are you guys just purely robotic? I know you weren't robotic, but I was just kind of wanted to see what you, as we flush out the answers, yeah, so to speak.
No, I think you have to be really, just in general, a great idea. If you're trying to approach sports betting in any league, any sport, just real quick, you need to be open-minded. Like you have to be at least willing to accept someone else's idea or hypothesis or theory, and then test it and see if you think it has validity. If it doesn't, move on. If it might, then that's going to make your ROI increase, you know, exponentially. Like there's always things that you need to be checking and testing. So always stay open-minded when it comes to these types of scenarios or angles.
I could not agree more. I've always said, you know, you'll get tweets here and there. Oh, I followed you on this. I'm always scared. Like no one should follow anyone blindly. I think you should always listen to people that you think are worth listening to. Of course, there's a lot of hacks out there, obviously. But like my biggest like strength, if you will, is just aggregating information and like filtering. I feel like I have a solid rotation of people on the show, the podcast, friends I text and stuff like that. And I'm pretty good at like sort of filtering it. And I think with people who listen to this podcast, watch Daily Way, I think you should just kind of like absorb and aggregate as much information and kind of views on games, and you can hear it. Like Stanford Steve and I joked a couple of times, like we'll do radio hits throughout the week, and I'm sure you do too. And he's like, you know, I'll do the same 3 games like all week, and by the end of the week, I'm like, you know, one of those games may not, you know, as I'm presenting, yeah, the case, it's maybe not that strong, and like you'll like the other two a lot more. And you can do that as a listener, right? And there's other networks out there, and you can hear people's picks and. And you can sort of kind of be like, you know, I really agree with that. Or it could cut through to you. And maybe you're both wrong, but at least it's your call on that pick. Whereas you're not just following someone blindly and whatever. I just think that's the best way to go about all of this.
Sounds like you're not very confident in your best bet later today.
Not as much as I was yesterday. Yesterday I had that pick. Actually, I had it probably Saturday night. And that's something to model too is – flat spots, revenge spots. I mean, Duke Carolina goes to overtime and the craziness, and I just grab my phone. I'm like, when do these two teams play next? Now, I liked FSU because I thought it was crazy high. I would not have been on them like if it was like 6. But I just was like, Carolina's done. Like Carolina, because their season was the Duke game. It's not like they're going to.
It hinged on that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And then they have to go, and it's like a non-sexy game going to at Wake. It wasn't like another big game where they could get up for like a Virginia or something like that. And then Wake's playing well. Now, I didn't expect a 20-point blowout, but I was like, yeah, that has to be my bet. Now, that happens like once or twice a season, like that kind of spot. Just a perfect storm of the excruciating loss. A team like Carolina that has such high aspirations, the blue chip program. So, obviously, they're never that easy or rarely that easy. But there's no – like, if let's say your model said, like, Carolina was a play. Would you have been all over – would you have, like, stayed away because of your gut?
Well, this might be a nice segue into some college hoops in general, but this shocked me. For people that were following Daily Wager since Cole Anthony returned, you guys know I was pro North Carolina. Yeah, like yeah. when they played Florida State themselves, Duke, like I thought that the numbers were a little extreme the other way. I was like, look, they've had some bad 3-point shooting variants go their way, especially that Boston College loss, which was by 1 point that everyone pointed to saying, oh, look, UNC still stinks with Anthony. Like he actually came off the bench, scored 26 points in 26 minutes. Like that's great. So for me, I do not understand after seeing that Duke game and having been a North Carolina second half backer where essentially they just needed to win the game for me to cover. I do not know how they opened a 1.5-point underdog. And by the night before, like the very day it opened till nighttime, they were laying 2. I don't get it. And then it never actually moved from there, really, the entire day where limits actually increase and more influential money comes into the market. I had Wake a 2-point favorite, and I had been pro Carolina for like 3 games in a row. And so I didn't understand it. And that was before the spot. So you asked, had I have bet Carolina, had I shown an edge? Somehow I didn't. I was like completely reversed the other way. But that's one of those where I probably would just pass, where I would just say, like you said, you know, that was about the spot of all spots for North Carolina. They really, if they wanted a shot at the tournament, they had to beat Duke. They didn't do it. That was it. That was their season in a nutshell, because we play in a format where, you know, there's this tournament, there's some at-large teams, and unless they win the ACC tournament now, you know, they're probably left out.
Right. And those spots don't come around very often. But and that's what I, you know, as we've talked a lot on the show and stuff like that, you do have that sort of one filter, like, is this a bad spot? Things like that. And it has to be probably extreme situation like this was to kind of get you off something. But
yeah.
It is fascinating because you do have revenge spots a lot. I mean, tonight there's a few examples, right? Auburn at home, and then you have there's a couple other.
Villanova is another one against Marquette.
Correct. Yeah. And then a third one, too. So there are spots where, like, you can kind of – there. But now that's sometimes baked in the line, though. So Alabama handed Auburn its first loss. So Auburn's catching them at home, and they're laying 7.5. West Virginia, Kansas, another revenge spot. And so West Virginia – lost at the Fog. Now they're laying 1.5 at home, but that's baked in the line, you would think, or at least the market move. That's sort of the thought process. But there's a team last night that played that is pretty highly ranked and pretty undervalued in your eyes.
San Diego State. Yeah, I was surprised. So I mean, it was just a normal bet. There wasn't anything drastic about it. I thought they should have been a 19-point favorite against New Mexico. I bet 15s and 15.5s. We did it on the show. It worked out. It easily could have lost, you know, in my opinion, like 44-point-something% of the time. Luckily, it won for us. But San Diego State as a whole just really intrigues me because they're 25-0, and they're still getting dismissed as a team that can actually make a run in March. And I understand why. On one side of it, they've never been that good come tournament time. Mountain West Conference teams generally aren't. They've really just been mostly defense, and they've had an average offense, and that's how they grind out wins. But then come tournament time, when other defenses are playing even better, like, they just haven't been able to score enough. And people don't realize, and I have them ranked a little bit lower. I think they're like 11th in my offensive adjusted efficiency rating, but KenPom has them top 10 in both adjusted offensive efficiency and defensive efficiency. They're the only team in the country that's top 10 in both. And so this is like an elite team now. They can score the basketball. They shoot nearly 39% from three. We saw a bunch of them going down in that second half as they pulled away. They're 25-0, and no one is giving them a chance. I think they should be the sixth favorite. I actually think they win just over 6% of the time. They're going to win it all. And no one's even talking about the Aztecs, and they're 25-0. I just don't get it. I had to go for it yesterday just because there was value in the single game. But I had to talk about them just because I felt – and I have friends that graduated from there, being from Southern California. Maybe that's part of it, is I'm trying to root them on. But I really dug in. I was like, this is one of the best teams in the country. Like, we should just admit it, and hopefully they can actually make a run and they don't fall as short as they have in the past, because their offense is going to be tough to stop.
So you think the mid-major component, but also more so the past performances of San Diego State, is sort of skewing the perception?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've seen that even with Gonzaga to an extent, where they were the one seed the one year. I mean, Kelly Olynyk maybe was one of the main guys on that team, and they lost to Pitt as a one seed, like, the next or second round. So you've seen Gonzaga never quite win at all. And so you'll see, actually, like, last year, I thought there was value on Gonzaga to win their region. Virginia was in the same boat because they've never been able to figure it out in the tournament. But, like, people don't realize, like, these you haven't been able to figure out in the tournament is like a sample size of like 3 to 7 tournaments. Like, it's just so small and so insignificant. So if Gonzaga still projects, which for me, they're the second best team in the country this year, they should project to win the national championship about the second most often, depending on how the bracket shakes out. But for now, that's where I have it. So some of these teams, like San Diego State, what was the other one we were talking about? Virginia, who ends up winning it all anyways. Like, people just kind of disregard the teams that fail to do it when they were expected to make a run. And so San Diego State, I think they did it probably 2 or 3 times where they were out early, and now no one wants to give them credit. And I'll jump in. I'll say San Diego State is going to make a run this year. I think their offense is just the difference maker ultimately in this season versus the others.
Yeah. See, I think Dayton's going to be my play. Obviously it depends on how the bracket looks and matchups, but I think Dayton's
they're fit,
like,
for me.
Yeah. So for real. I just think people don't really understand how good Toppin is and how balanced they are. I love Dayton. But again, it's all about the bracket and the matches. But I'm glad you mentioned Virginia, because that's just something in the sports radio guy in me just can't stand. It's just because something hasn't happened, they think it won't happen. And I'm so glad Virginia won, because I can't tell you how many sort of casual sports fan friends of mine, not necessarily bettors, who just kind of dismiss them. I can't win. It's like, just because they've lost a couple coin flip games over the years doesn't mean they can't. And I think that same thing has been said about Mike D'Antoni over the years. I think the Suns got jobbed in 2007 with the Robert Horry suspension and all that stuff, Steve Nash and bloody and all that. And then just other years. I mean, like we talked about it earlier with the Rockets, and D'Antoni revolutionized offense with the 7 seconds or less. And he's just, I think, a brilliant offensive mind. I think he definitely had some defensive issues, especially with the Lakers. But I just want D'Antoni to get a ring, or just get his kind of what's due, his kind of respect that's due to him.
That's another great example. Like, they had maybe two or three shots on the Suns and maybe two shots on the Rockets, just because they're 0-for-4 winning titles. Like, because they lost in the game 7 to the Spurs, who ended up sweeping the Cavs, if I recall, or the Warriors, one of the greatest teams we've ever seen. Like, doesn't mean that Mike D'Antoni teams can't win it. Like, it absolutely could be a winning team or process. It just hasn't occurred yet. Some bad luck, probably why it hasn't occurred yet. But yeah, great point. I think that's a great comp, kind of the Mike D'Antoni being maybe the mid-majors of college basketball or Virginia before last year.
Yeah, and people forget about this one. People sleep on this. Stackhouse taking out Joe Johnson. This was before the suspension of the guys, the Marion. I think it was Sean Marion who came off the bench. Joe Johnson broke his orbital bone, and that Suns team lost. That definitely could have won it all that year. The 07 team definitely got robbed, but that team had it as well. So a lot of talent on there. I want to end up with this. This is kind of like a running joke, more off air than on air, but we've started to bring it on air. At least I have. Is Martingale.
Yeah.
And it's a old school sort of betting term. Kind of applies to basically like roulette and blackjack, right? Like you keep doubling your bet until you win, and it's like you can't lose, right? And obviously you can. So is that the fair sort of cliff note version of what martingaling is?
Yeah, that would be it. If you lose one game, you bet 2x the next game, then you bet 4x and 8x and 16x. Like, yeah, you just keep going until you win that one unit back, and then you start over,
right,
more or less.
Right, and some would argue that it's like trying to pick up a nickel in front of a steamroller. At some point, they're going to, like, get your hand smashed, and it's just not worth the nickel. And so in the concept of the roulette and then blackjack, maybe roulette's a better example in this case, is just like that. Those are fixed odds, and whereas there's market correction on some of these. So some – you know, we joked about it last summer, like, just do Yankees team total over every game. Like, how many are they going to go under in a row? Like, 4 or 5 tops? And it's just that with that lineup and whatever. So that's sort of like the philosophy. But I want to table that discussion. And the reason you shake your head and laugh every time I say it on air is because you believe in the closing line of these markets, not maybe like week one of the XFL, but just like the NBA and the NFL, is just pretty like tight market, right? It's a 50-50 outcome with the point spread.
Yeah, it's especially tough. I mean, it's hard even on our show, like, not making excuses, but I mean, we're betting, you know, near post, like right before tip off or first pitch. It's tough to beat those markets. Like, hitting, if you can break even doing that, then it means you're probably a very profitable bettor betting early in the morning. If you can't even break even there, then you're probably not worth, you know, following even in the early morning. But that's how you can kind of gauge where you're at when you're betting. Is, you know, you're betting right before a game starts when the market is as mature and sharp as possible. You know, that makes it tougher. But it's why you need to respect what that number is, and why, yeah, the NBA, the NFL markets especially are really efficient.
Okay, so my question on that, and we'll get back to martingaling, but I've always sort of tried to, like, look at, I don't know if the bell curve example, I want to revisit this, but again, like these simulations of these games, if a total in a game is 200, but if you chop up the quarters to 50 each, the market's not saying that every quarter is going to be 50, is it? Is that right? Is that fair to assume that's not what that necessarily means? It's more like throughout the course of the game will be total 200 points.
Yep, that's totally fair. As a whole, as an average, especially in the NBA, you'll have the first half shaded a little higher than the second half. Right. Things do slow down in the fourth quarters. The first quarter will be shaded even a little bit more than the first half line would be, though, too. But you also have certain teams that there are tendencies or, if you want to say, trends. But ultimately, I think the Suns is a good example. Just the other night, they were playing, it might have been that Houston game, where the total was, I believe, in the 230s, but the first half was like 113.5, 113. So it was actually less than that first half. And the Suns have been a team that have actually been scoring and giving up more points in second halves and fourth quarters. Celtics is another one where their second half scoring and fourth quarters have been higher than average. And so you'll see certain shaded things. Like the Nets was a great example last year. I remember you brought it up on a show or a podcast where their first half lines just were like four or five points off what you would expect on average. So there's going to be some caveats, I guess, on certain teams that have different ways that they approach games. Or it also is going to be dependent on what the spread is, right? Because if it's one of those spreads that's like 6 to 8, which means more often than any other numbers, they're going to be fouling more the final minute or two. And I feel like the Suns have been in a lot of those instances where maybe it's not necessarily the way the Suns are playing, but just the way they've matched up. And they've been in a lot of these games where they're single digits, but they're trailing and they're very good at fouling. Devin Booker quick to foul again. And then they have guys that can hit threes too, or Ricky Rubio will just get to the line real quick or get to the hole for a layup. So you have to really kind of dig into some of those tendencies for a difference. But ultimately, to your point, I know I kind of went on a tangent.
No, it's good.
The 50-50-50-50 for a 200 total is going to be close, but there is a general shade to the first quarter and then the first half, and then the second half is usually a little bit lower.
Okay, so the next step of this is I want to apply narrative. So, like, my whole thing is anytime there's a game 7 in hoops, I've always just kind of martingale the unders. And, like, you usually hit, you know, you're going to hit one of them, like, usually the first quarter. Just, you know, the narrative is, like, tight defense, you know, whatever. So more importantly, we joke, but I would think it would work. Obviously, it depends how much credit you have and how many outs. But some of these teams that are like, I basically said, like, if you chop up this efficient market, it becomes less efficient, right? By when it's smaller segments, right? Like I said, each quarter line. So if you do the Bucks, who are just like a covering machine and, like, you know, they're reliable and all that stuff, like, how many halves in a row can they go without covering?
So I need to say one thing or else someone will point it out. College is not like NBA. I was using NBA examples.
Right. Second halves.
College first halves. Yeah, college first halves are actually shaded down, but they're generally shaded down for most schools. So just something to note in case someone's like, hey, this is 75, but the total is 160, like the Auburn game tonight. Just wanted to make a point. As far as the Bucks go and, like, your point here, it's hard for me to grasp it. Ultimately, like, I've told you this, like, I've walked through casinos and seen the roulette table hit red 18 times in a row. And I'm as trying to be as logical as possible. I'll stand there and just be like, man, I got at least just like throw $100 on black. Like, it's got to be black eventually. But I usually like start doing that after 11 or 12 and then I see 6 or 7 more go. Like, it just happens over the course of time. Now, is there more variance in your angle within a game? Like, you can't stay on an over pace of 200 four times in a row because there's going to be ebbs and flows in basketball. It's like the nature of the sport. Like, yeah, it's one of those other things where it's hard to qualify and quantify and really say. But I mean, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe if you did bet the Bucks every quarter in a game that's like around pick or one, like today against the Pacers, what are the odds they lose all four quarters? Like, probably slim. So maybe there is something there. It's maybe slimmer than 1 in 16 is what I'm getting at, but also it might just be 1 in 16. It's one of those things that's really tough to test and really say, all right, this is an edge. But it's people do it all the time. It's what the nature of chasing kind of, right? I think stems from the martingale. Even if you're not strictly going 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, you're going, crap, I went like 5 and 10 today on Saturday hoops, but there's one more game. It's Hawaii. I'm going to bet 5X and try to get close to even. Like, that's what people do a lot. It's really,
now that I don't encourage. Like, that's right, now straight that's chasing.
That's a 50% shot now, but you're betting 5 times as much as you normally would. It's an awful decision, an awful bet. But maybe there is something to the nuances of a game where certain teams that really perform well, like the Bucks, it's just harder than the typical 1 in 16 chance you would say that they lose every quarter against the Pacers. Like, maybe there's something there. I can't say there.
Yeah, and to be fair,
there is,
but my example with the Bucks wasn't quarters. It was more like each half moving forward, like then over a course of like 5 games. Like, you, so their ceiling is
so
much
times. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, like, the narrative, and that's why it's different than like roulette in my eyes, is that, like, with effort is such a big thing in a course of any sport that has a long season, like hoops, is like, you know, you're going to get their best effort and they're going to outperform their point spread against an opponent at some point because their ceiling is so high when they're going, you know, balls to the wall, which they will when they're struggling. So that's kind
of. Now, I will say this real quick. I'm going to interject. If you might be right, especially earlier in the seasons, if you're right about a team and you're ahead of where the market's moving anyways on a team, like if you were doing this with the Raptors for the last month and a half, congratulations, you're rich. If you were doing it with a different team that's been losing, like you could just also be wrong in those instances. But if you think you're right and you want to do some sort of approach that's betting on a certain team or betting against a certain team, like it could pay off. But at this point in the NBA season, for me, like coming up on All-Star break, they're pretty efficient lines. There's going to be some value here and there, especially when certain guys are in and out and the market hasn't adjusted completely correctly, in my opinion. But ultimately, I mean, if they have to outperform expectations, right? So even you're talking about the Bucks in a half, they might be laying 8.5. And that's still the market saying is a 50% proposition. It doesn't, they're not more likely to cover 8.5 because they didn't cover the last three halves of basketball, not to mention two of them were against a different team, different personnel. So ultimately, that's why for me, it's still there's nothing there. I've never tried it. But if you're doing it in spots earlier in the season and you're trying to get ahead of valuing a team and where the market will value a team, then it's probably a way that you can, you know, legitimately win without losing more than two or three in a row if you're just right about a team being really good or really bad early on.
Or strong tendencies like a Virginia in college, like they're unders. Like when you have a team.
Yeah, this season was ugly.
Structured like that. Like they may go over three games in a row, but like at some point, like, you know, their commitment to defense or whatever. It's just fascinating to talk about because of the A, market correction, but B, just like the narratives of sports. And I think it's fun. And by the way, and we'll wrap things up. I would caution anyone who's betting heavy on NBA tonight and tomorrow. It is dangerous going into the All-Star weekend. You mentioned the All-Star break where we are in the juncture of the season. There's a lot of players and guys who have one foot out the door. And actually, we're working up some stats for tonight's show in terms of underdogs covered, alarming rate when they're big underdogs, like 8 or 10
nice.
Points. I actually remember vividly the Lakers and or a Nuggets game a long time ago, and Doug Collins was on the call, and he's like, man, All-Star, it was that Thursday night late TNT game. It was like, man, you never know what you're going to get from your team that game before the All-Star break. And it's just sometimes they're planning parties at the Super Bowl, or excuse me, at the All-Star city, which is Chicago in this case, or they're going on a getaway with their own friends and family. Just taking advantage of the week off. So it's always a little dangerous, and I had to learn the hard way in a couple times. So
maybe worth some money line shots on the dogs. If you like the dog anyway, just a couple bullets there might be worthwhile.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. All right, my man. Well, great stuff as always. Really, really enjoyed the thorough discussion. I appreciate you pacifying my martingale questions and tolerance.
I tried, yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm a big believer in you, like the roulette wheel thing. Do not just keep doubling up.
Stop. Hammer time.
Time now to welcome in a legend, maybe even the legend of all sports betting and bookmaking in the industry. A man who's been around forever, Jimmy Vaccaro. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing fine, young man. Wow, I don't know how I can live up to that billing you just gave me, but it's been something that I enjoyed my entire life. And naturally, I would consider myself pretty lucky, you know, coming to Las Vegas in what I would consider the renaissance of sports betting, where it got into the hotels and the public got involved. So it's been a lot of fun, my friend. And, you know, we got a long way to go yet.
I'm excited, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But the reason I want to get you on is for a variety of reasons. But yesterday, the 30-year anniversary of arguably the biggest upset in sports history, Mike Tyson losing in Tokyo to Buster Douglas, and you were the only person to put up odds on this fight. I guess take me back to 1980. You were at the Mirage, and what led to you wanting to put up odds? Because nowadays, you know, it's common to put up odds on anything, but that wasn't the case back then. So just set the scene for us.
All right, my friend. First of all, it's February 10th or 11th, 1990, which puts it on 30 years.
Yeah.
And the reason is like some of the date gets mixed up. Remember, they fought in Tokyo, so they were like 8 hours ahead of time. So if someone wanted to meet the deadline, it was actually February 11th over there. Over here was February 10th. But getting back to what I enjoyed most of all, and Doug, I'm sure you've read and were a part of also, but I was there at a golden era when the boxing was such a big thing, and Las Vegas had all these major fights for about a 20-year run. It was incredible. I can't even begin to sit down and tell you how many great fights. And they're every 3 or 4 months, as opposed to now you got to wait 2 or 3 years for it. So it was easy. And I obviously took a liking to this kid, the way he was fighting. And I go back thinking of when he smashed Marvis Frazier. I think Marvis Frazier is still laying on the canvas. That was way back when. And then when he almost knocked Michael Spinks through the ropes and knock his chest out. I put odds up on those things. I think the first one with Marvis Frazier was just simply around 6-1. And then with the destruction there, then the next big fight, I think I opened them 10-1. So I kept putting odds up on these fights, and no one else would. So I always enjoyed booking and taking bets on these fights. So here it is. It's like, wow, they made this date in Tokyo with Iron Mike Tyson to what at the time was considered just a journeyman. I think he had lost 4 or 5 leading up to that time. So I just stood there, and one day I said to myself, you know, 27-1 sounds like a good number. And from that particular point, my friend, I guess the rest is history. The first bet I took within maybe 24 hours was one of the sharp guys in town who laid the 27-1 for 54,000 to win 2,000. And that just kept going up and up and up for the remainder of, like, getting up to the fight. The biggest bet on the favorite, a guy laid like 160,000 at 42-1 to win $4,000. There was buyback on the other side with the dog money, all small tickets, but we wound up winning 300,000. I do remember vividly because we didn't have it on TV in the sportsbook at the Mirage at the time. So I stayed there the entire waiting for the ticker to come across every round to give a little bit of an update. From that particular point, now that came across that Douglas had won, and I remember running into the control room telling the kids, I said, don't put that final score in yet. I said, it's got to be wrong. I don't want to wind up paying both sides of it. Then when it came across, naturally, that was obviously a go. And, yes, Alan Feldman, PR man for the Mirage way back when, his phone and my phone started ringing. So starting in the morning, I was 15 minutes of fame. I was on every big talk show only because he had lost the fight. If he won the fight, nothing would have happened. Then naturally, 8 months later when James Buster Douglas really made a fool of himself when he went out to fight Holyfield and wasn't in shape. So it's been a long ride. I enjoy it, and some things I did turned out good. A lot of things I did didn't turn out good, but that one was a big one. I still enjoy thinking and talking about it, my friend.
We covered the story on yesterday, that 30-year anniversary to the day, and we had Jeremy Schapp on. And Schapp did a piece in the 30 for 30, co-directed it, and you were obviously a big part of that because you were the only odds maker to put up the odds, and it was good to have that old footage. And, Jimmy, I got to be surprised. I didn't realize you once had a mullet.
I once had a what?
You had a mullet with a long hair in the back then.
Well, give me, you know, that's 30 years ago, yeah, my friend. My hair was black, and I could stay up after 8 o'clock during the course of the day. But, you know, Jeremy did a great piece on it also. I'm so proud to be a part of that. Like you would know as well as anybody, sometimes you do certain things like that. It doesn't turn out the way that you thought it should turn out. In this case, with Jeremy, it was really, really great, and I still get a lot of feedback from it. So, yeah, it was done properly, and, you know, I was factual because I was obviously there, so it was fun. And yes, my hair was long, and don't hold that against me, my friend.
No,
you know, your
no.
hair will be getting gray another 15 years too.
No, I just loved the style back then. No, but it was such authentic footage, and I want people to really appreciate just how different it was. Not only was Mike Tyson this spectacle in an era with no internet, in an era that not everyone had cable, but just the nature of boxing, not every day. And so you had
right.
this, such an event town, and then obviously Las Vegas being the entertainment capital of the world, and then the betting was so different because prop bets weren't really uncovered because a few years later you were famously became a 15 minutes of fame again with the fridge and the 300 something to pound defensive lineman to score a touchdown in that
yeah.
Super Bowl against the Patriots. So you certainly have moved the needle in terms of betting for a couple instances.
Well, you know what, my friend, it was there, and I surely had an understanding of what it was, and so I would just try to think ahead a little bit, and I was given the green light from people like Michael Gunn, who I ended up working for now some 40 years later, and naturally Steve Wynn and Kirk Kerkorian. You know, with them, the sportsbook was brand new, and they trusted my feel, they trusted my understanding, and the one thing they've all told me, and Michael Gunn said it this way, he said, kid, he said, you can make a mistake once. So he gave me a lot of leeway to go out there. So, you know, you go back to the boxing, I can never stop talking about it. I mean, Hearns Hagler, I mean, that was the greatest, you know, 3 minutes of boxing you ever saw in the first round. The betting was like Super Bowl Sunday. The betting at the time, I was at the Barbary Coast, and it literally, and I'm not kidding, the line was out the door on one side to Flamingo Road, on the other side of Las Vegas Boulevard, and the line didn't break until about a half hour before the fight had started. And I remember running across the street to Caesar's Palace. You know, how can you forget, you know, Holmes trying to tell the referee, you know, I'm going to kill Muhammad Ali if you don't stop this fight. I can remember Hearns knocking out Duran. I think Duran still knocked out. And these fights came, Doug, you know, every 3 or 4 months. So it was easy to get into rhythm. It was easy to get into, like, you know, what was going on. And trust me, the betting was absolutely through the roof. Yes, with only maybe two ways to bet. Pick the winner of the fight, and naturally, if the fight would go over a certain distance, then in the round props. But the, other than that, but like I said, I was so fortunate to be a part of it. And yes, I did like the betting, and I like to see money flying around, and there was a lot of money flying around in those days on those fights. And I can, you know, I'm going to take up all your time, but I can still remember going to the Hawk, to the Hacienda where they had fights. I can remember seeing James Toney being the walkout fight at the Sands, you know, years before that. I went to a lot of the fights, you know, way back when. I truly enjoyed them, and it wound up going good for me also.
Well, I want to. So you talked about the money flying around. Look, this is 1990, and you're taking $160,000 cash to win four.
Right.
I mean, how common was that to see that kind of cash on the counter?
Well, that was a new type of betting. You didn't see too much of when I first came to town. It was simply just, well, first of all, it wasn't a public-oriented gambling scheme way back when on events like that. Yeah, people did come to town, and they bet their $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $10,000 on Super Bowl Sunday, whatever. But it started to change when people found out if I just pick the winner of this event, even though I'm laying a big price, I know that I'm going to win. You remember Carl Icahn put up $2.4 million in the Super Bowl with the 49ers. To win $300,000 against San Diego there. So $2.4 million, he was laying 8-1 on a fight. So it was something that now it's commonplace. I mean, I'm sure you see it now with all these big bets that are flashing around anymore. I have never seen this gate open up in the last 10 years like it has, and it's not going to stop. We got some customers that lay these huge, huge prices, but, you know, their answer simply is, Doug, you know, okay, I'm going to give Jimmy this money for a few hours, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to pick up $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000, or $10,000. You never saw that way back when because these so-called wise guys would never consider laying a price over 2-1 on anything, let alone even if, you know, tomorrow they knew the date was coming up on it. But that has change, and it changes, and you can see the legalization of sports betting. You can see the amount of money bet, and you can see, like, you know, for us at the South Point, we're not the biggest book, but for us, we took a $200,000 bet, you know, on the Chiefs that day. And how about this? It was actually $190,000. We actually ended up needing that guy to win his bet because the 49er money after that came pouring in. So it's a different animal. It's a different time, and the money is flying around right now also, my friend.
I alluded to it, but you weren't the only book that took those Super Bowl bets on the fridge, but was that the tipping point, do you think, on prop bets and everything else? Sort of, I mean, look, there's stages, right? That was the Tyson, the Tyson fight with Douglas was a stage. Was that sort of the next benchmark?
Oh, that was a huge benchmark for the reason, as I said it 1,000 times, and I'm sure if you talk to everybody else around the city too, they give you the same answer, probably on the same rails that I'm on right now. What had happened when he scored? It was just like, okay, at that time, everybody was screaming and hollering. But what had happened, naturally being from Chicago, I remember taking the first, what I would consider the big interview. It was a newspaper writer from Chicago, because here it is, the Bears, what they win, like 45-10, something like that. Refridge scored the touchdown. It was an all-new way of doing business out here, and they wanted to know more and more and more about it. So what happened, that kicked off, Doug, is like, wow. And then people, they would read about it, and then all of a sudden, every time there was an event, now the media kept calling us saying, have you taken anything like you did with the Refridge? So in other words, what it did, it opened up another door for all the media to call before an event and say, hey, what are you guys doing? So being competitive, you know, with Art Manteras across the street and Jay at the Hilton and Jerry Ludd at the Barbie Coast, it was kind of a fun, you know, picking at each other, trying to outdo each other. So I kind of remember maybe the first time we did what you would consider, you know, a lot of props on the board, maybe 15 of them. That was like in the early 80s. Now, as you see, there's 300 of them. But yes, the refrigerator thing had a lot to do with the media. Hey, what's going on in Las Vegas? Tell me more about it. And then once that hit, then naturally it was like Katie barred the door.
And now, do you ever kind of scratch your head and laugh at the in a chuckle kind of way that now the NFL's in Vegas and the NFL's partnering with advertising companies and now they're embracing betting?
Wow. Don't get me started on that one, my friend. It's a shame. You know, I saw Goodell. He was here, made the big announcement, whatever. What a great place to come and play. We got our team here. And, you know, 2 years ago, this guy wouldn't have taken my phone call. I mean, it was, yes, so I do laugh. And I do laugh to some degree because I've been around for so long now that, like, you know, what took them 30-some-odd years to legalize sports betting in the United States across the country? It's silly. And as it's proving out, obviously now it's a new ballgame. I'll give you a good story. Obviously, everyone knows about Mattress Mack. So I've known Jim, you know, from 17 when he first came to town, introduced himself and started betting then and there. And so naturally, so now he came to town and I saw him a few weeks ago and we talked about it. And I brought this up, and just think about this. Like Texas, you can't make a bet on the sports. But here's a person who lives in Texas, who's a great, you know, he does great things for the state of Texas, but he had to take his $1 million out to go across the state line to make a bet. In other words, all the tax revenue he created with that $1 million bet wasn't even beneficial to the state of Texas. So somewhere down the line, I think he has something to do with the you know, Texas getting legalized sports betting. I'm not saying it's going to be overnight, but isn't it silly? You got one of the bigger players in the world playing it with you, and he's not even utilizing that money to bet in the state that he's from. Think about that, my friend. Goodell never brought that kind of stuff up, did he?
No. And as you very well know, the local municipalities need that revenue. I have one final question, and I mentioned earlier 1980. That was on the back of my mind because that was the final question. Next week is the 40-year anniversary of the Miracle on Ice, and just take me back. I don't think there was Olympic betting allowed, or what exactly was it, and did you have a money line on that? It was a semifinal game. Some people forget that. It wasn't the gold medal game. It was a semifinal. U.S. still had to win the next one to get the gold, but just what were the odds back then? And I think there was a futures market where they were anywhere between 300 and 500 to 1 to win it.
I never saw the future market on that, so I can't comment on that. I don't think, again, we're talking 1980, and there was a lot of sports books in the casinos at the time. And I remember the Harry Gordon's Churchill Downs and the famous and the Rose Bowl. I don't think they had that fight on the had that thing on the board also. What we did have, I'm at the Barbie Coast then, and we had the game up there. And once again, here we go. It wasn't a miracle on ice as far as like the number was concerned. My old brain keeps saying bouncing around 6-1 was the favor we had on Russia there, so the take back was on the other side, and we had tape delay there, so it was not like a lot of interest betting on the fight. So on the hockey match there. So yes, there were odds on them. I don't remember the future betting on it, but I do remember that we had that on the board, and it was like, well, you consider a fair size favor, but nothing, you know, crazy.
So -600 or +600?
-600 +400. Okay. I think that's what I was using at the bar because, and my friend, not a lot of money on it, some small tickets. And I do believe it was tape delayed. So once again, that took some air out of the balloon too.
Exactly. Yeah. Not as much interest in the handle, just from an entertainment standpoint to watch the game.
Right.
Jimmy, we always appreciate the time. You are a pioneer in the industry and always full of great stories. I always joke that you're a walking soundbite. But I'm honored to have been able to call you a friend for 15 years when I moved to Vegas initially, and then here I am now. But it's always great to catch up, and I know our listeners appreciate it too.
All right, my friend. Anything you ever need, just give me a call, buddy.
Money won is twice as sweet as money earned.
Okay, and thanks to Jimmy for that. Let's talk about DraftKings again. It's giving new users a free shot at over $100,000. Download the DraftKings app and enter code Doug at signup. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. And I want to wrap things up talking a little XFL and bring in one of our new producers, Christina Buswell. Christina, first time on the pod here, but not first time in the control room.
Very true. First time.
And you were firing on XFL games.
I was. I bet on a couple. I hit on everything, so that was great.
Solid.
First time betting on anything. So, yeah, that's great.
So take me through it. So how many games did you fire on?
So I bet Defenders -10, Guardians plus 3.5, and I bet the under in the Battlehawks versus Renegades game.
Okay, so you went 3-0.
Yep.
That Defenders game was pretty crazy. It was the inaugural game.
It was awesome.
That was Saturday afternoon, and point spread drama on both the side
yes.
and the total.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just take our listeners through this briefly. You were laying 10. That was the high end. So it was like anywhere from 6.5 to 10.
Mm-hmm.
And the over-under was up to 51.5 is what I closed, I believe. And what's cool is you can just look at the highlights and it says it on the graphic of the score bug.
Yeah, it was awesome.
So it was a 12-point game, right? So the
yes.
Defenders are up 12, and they decide to kick a field goal on fourth down because in the XFL, making it a 9-point game is actually a one-score game because you can get 6 and then a 3. And there was enough time left. It was midway through the fourth, so you could conceivably get a couple scores. But so you're sitting there, and they're kicking the field goal, and you're like, oh, no, I'm not going to cover. And
then I'm getting nervous.
And then he makes the field goal.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you got there? What's going through your mind then when you're only up 9? You're like, well, maybe we can get some points.
So nervous, especially since it was the first game I've ever bet on. So I'm sitting there thinking, oh, great. It's the first game I've ever bet on. I'm going to lose it. So great start. but, no, we came back, and I hit it. So it was awesome.
Right. So running into the kicker, and then they take points off the board knowing that the 6 plus the 3 and to get a 3-point conversion is the conversion from the 10-yard line. So they did take points off the board. Then it was second and goal. And by the way, that field goal made it over the total. So it was a double whammy. And then they took it off the board. And then second and goal, they fumble. DC recovers. And then that's your final score ultimately. So they win by 12 and it stays under. So
exactly.
Way to like, you always remember your first, right?
Oh, yeah.
And that was your introduction into betting. That was pretty crazy.
Great introduction.
And that was, again, the first season. So a little, not just the first week, but also the first season. So a little cherry on top. And look ahead to week 2. Do you have your eye on any games?
So I tried to Google around
uh-huh.
because I am a first-time bettor. I just have a few questions
okay.
in terms of what would your advice be for somebody who I kind of not necessarily blindly picked my first weekend of bets, but I wasn't exactly sure what I was doing.
I think everyone was blindly betting.
I wasn't even, I didn't even have a full handle on how the scoring was going to go,
right.
how the games were going to turn out. So with all of that aside.
Well, to be honest, like odds makers were kind of blindly too. It was like looking at head
yeah.
coaches, quarterbacks.
I don't think anybody knew what we were really doing.
Right.
But
I would say that my biggest takeaway from week one, and I watched a lot and I got involved a little bit, is that live betting presents some opportunities because like a lot of times the live line, the in-game line is sort of like based on the algorithm of the original game line. Well, it's not exactly the tightest market, right? These opening game lines are like, who says the right team's even favored, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You're looking at a roster and you're looking at home field advantage. So there's so much ambiguity with it all that I thought there was some real value in live line. I did okay. I hit both of my plays. But I would say just continue watching and absorb. And live wagering could be your thing. But there's definitely been some already like significant adjustments. I know there wasn't really much consideration for the Landry Jones injury last week. I think there should have been looking back. But I would say St. Louis could still have value grabbing plus 8 at Houston. That's the last game of the weekend. That catches my eye. But my advice to everyone would be to watch as much as you can, and then you can kind of get a feel. Because odds makers, frankly, like their eyes are on basketball right now.
Exactly. And that was my question was moving into weekend 2 – I'm looking at all the games. I'm looking at who won, who lost last weekend. Taking all of that into account, what would be your biggest piece of advice in terms of picking who I should be betting on going into weekend 2?
I would say keep watching. I do like the home dogs. There's 3 of them. I would say all 3 home dogs catch my eye. But, again, just keep watching. That would be my thing is just absorb it all. You don't need to fire on week 2 if you're not feeling it. You can always wait till week 3, 4, 5. There's 10 weeks total. No buys. And that would be my biggest piece of advice, per se.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, I'm thinking the 2 games I'm loving so far, Guardians and Defenders, I think that's going to be a good one, considering it's a good matchup.
Okay.
Both teams
that's
played very
one.
Well last weekend, and I have decided that I'm a DC Defenders fan.
Okay.
So moving forward with that, I'm liking the Defenders. I think they played really well. But I think what I am looking to bet on would be the Dragons plus 2.5.
Okay.
That's what I'm looking for right now. I know they're really wanting a win. And they didn't play very well last weekend.
Right.
So.
It's up to three now. So you get the full three.
Oh, okay, cool.
Which is another thing is key numbers don't exactly exist like they do in NFL betting because of all the different point spreads.
Okay, awesome.
So, but still, three is always better than 2.5 if you can get it. But yeah, a little XFL for you.
Awesome.
And welcome to the pod. I know
Thank
Travis is still
much.
Involved for all our listeners. Might and that and something we did with Kai back in the day, and we'll do it again moving forward, is Confessions of a Non-Gambler. So you get to chime in and say, Doug, you made no sense with that comment. What do you mean by that? And then I can explain it. Because I think a lot of our listeners are relatively new to the space, or at least some of our listeners are. So I think that'll be helpful for everyone.
Yeah, I think so, too. I'm all in on the betting, so you can help
me out. And your dad's a big better, or not
oh,
big
yeah.
better, but the big sports fan, knows betting,
oh, yeah.
your brothers.
Yep. Well,
right.
Everybody in my family, all the guys in my family are big on it, so they're loving that I'm now in on it, too.
Love it. All right, well, welcome aboard. And I know I already said that on air, off air when you did join, but it's good that our listeners know your whereabouts, and we'll get you on more often. And just want to thank everyone. I know things have slowed down a little bit, but we'll be picking up. Moving forward, March Madness just around the corner, and we'll have some big announcements as well for both the podcast and Daily Wager in the near future. But until then, have a great rest of your week and weekend. We'll see you back here next week.